It is Monday, January 14th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for KUAF comes from the Rogers Historical Museum, offering real objects, true stories, family fun, and lifelong learning. Current exhibits include Benton County crime stories, Building Rogers, and to cap it all off, an exhibit on hats and hat making. Located in historic downtown Rogers, 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum for more information. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, combating plagiarism on college campuses with a new kind of blackboard. And we'll preview the 2013 session of the Arkansas Legislature. The General Assembly is opening today. And our conversation with Richard Sander, a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, who has written several controversial articles, papers, opinions, and a book about affirmative action. That conversation later on this edition of Ozarks at Large. First, U.S. Representative Tom Cotton stopped in Texarkana this weekend and talked with locals there about several issues. He weighed in on former U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel's nomination for the post of U.S. Secretary of Defense, a decision that Cotton has been critical of.
Just because I do think that he would not be the kind of advocate and champion for our troops that the current Secretary of Defense, who is a Democrat, Leon Panetta, has been. I also just think he has very dangerous views on Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah. And a very strange hostility towards Israel.
Representative Cotton has voiced his concern over the nomination to several news outlets, including the Wall Street Journal. Residents attending the event asked questions concerning a range of other topics, including gun control. The representative says he does not support an assault weapons ban or a ban on large capacity magazines.
Primarily because I don't think they're effective. The evidence shows that they have not decreased crime in general. They have not decreased mass murders in particular. We had an assault weapons ban in this country from 1994 to 2004. The Department of Justice has said there's no evidence that it reduced crime.
More than 60 people attended Representative Cotton's town hall meeting in Texarkana. The meeting was his first since taking the post of U.S. Representative of Arkansas's 4th Congressional District. He was sworn in earlier this month. Another Arkansas congressman, Tim Griffin, is calling on the president to, as he says, tell the American people the truth about the country's financial situation. Representative Griffin says it's much worse than the president has admitted to date. In a letter to the White House, Congressman Griffin wrote with Colorado Republican Cory Gardner, urging the president to use the upcoming State of the Union address to get real with the country about spending.
The national debt of the United States is not debatable. It is what it is. He ought to inform Americans in that speech how much our debt is. It's also not debatable that Medicare is on the road to bankruptcy, and the Medicare trustees estimate 7 to 9 years.
Congressman Griffin says the recently enacted tax increases will do very little to help the crisis. He says the annual deficit was a little more than $1 trillion before the tax increases, and now will be a little less than $1 trillion. He says the administration has produced $1 trillion in new deficit spending each of its 4 years. The State of the Union, by the way, is scheduled for February 12th. We'll have live coverage on KUAF. Arkansas House Speaker Davy Carter says a Medicaid funding shortfall is the biggest issue facing the state in its upcoming legislative session. On Friday, he told a lunchtime crowd at the Clinton School of Public Service that every conversation he's had in recent weeks has come around to that program. He says his goal is to direct funding toward education and economic development so that Medicaid services aren't as necessary.
I'm no way saying that necessary resources should not be allocated to help the ones in most need. What I'm saying is that there becomes a time when your policymakers are going to be forced into making hard choices between increasing our investment in things such as education and infrastructure and other worthy causes. I submit to you that that time is getting closer.
The speaker also says he's not convinced the state can afford an expansion of Medicaid that's part of the federal health care law. The speaker also spoke highly of the tenure of Governor Mike Beebe and praised the governor and other lawmakers for a $300 million surplus the state expects in its next fiscal year. He says some of that surplus should go toward shoring up the Medicaid funding gap. Tomorrow night, Fort Smith city directors will be faced with the decision of whether to allow urban archery deer hunts to help counter growing deer populations in the city. Fort Smith Police Chief Kevin Lindsay says that the main area where these proposed hunts would take place is in the Fort Chaffee redevelopment area.
The Chaffee Crossing folks are interested in pursuing something that not only would result in the reduction of the deer herd, but also to be conducted in a much safer way and in a more controlled manner. And that was the reason that this urban deer hunt has been proposed. My understanding is the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission have approached a number of other cities within the state of Arkansas. Several of them are actively pursuing these urban deer hunts. And the nice thing about them is that they are sanctioned by the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. There are a lot of administrative controls, many of which are safety issues.
Lindsay says many of the controls in place are safety precautions put in place by the Game and Fish Commission. The urban hunts have been conducted in a handful of communities around the state, the largest being Russellville. We'll have more on the proposed urban hunt in Fort Smith on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. The Bentonville School Board will hold a special meeting tonight with the purpose of discussing the results of a recent survey regarding growth options for the district's high school. Of the nearly 4,000 responses received by the school district, more than 2,200 responded. They were in favor of a second high school, but at a lower cost than was proposed in a millage election last year. The meeting tomorrow night will be held at 7 at the school administration building on Tiger Boulevard. The Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History has a new director. The University of Arkansas, which is home to the Pryor Center, announced today that after conducting a national search, Randy Dixon has been named director of the center. Dixon is the former news director of KATV in Little Rock. His appointment to lead the Pryor Center comes nearly 4 years after the Little Rock station donated some 24,000 hours of video and news film dating back to the 1950s. In addition to the usual managerial duties, Dixon will be responsible for two upcoming projects, one of which is the Arkansas Story Bus, a project with the goal of collecting more interviews with people from around the state. Dixon will also supervise the center's move to new facilities on the downtown Fayetteville Square. The University of Arkansas women's basketball team fell to Vanderbilt yesterday in Nashville, 78-58. The loss drops the Razorbacks to 1-3 in SEC play and 13-4 overall. They'll next play Georgia in Bud Walton Arena Thursday night. Friday, the number one ranked University of Arkansas men's indoor track and field team defeated number 3 Texas in a dual meet in Fayetteville. Also Friday, the number 7 women's team defeated Oklahoma State in a dual meet. The men's and women's track and field teams will next participate at a meet in Texas A&M. That's on Saturday. Partly cloudy, lows from 12 in northwest Arkansas tonight to about 20 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-30s in northwest Arkansas, around 40 tomorrow for the Arkansas River Valley. And for tomorrow night, partly cloudy, still cold, lows around 14 tomorrow night in northwest Arkansas, around 21 for the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas spring semester begins today. But some professors and students have already been gathering around the Blackboard, a virtual classroom computer program where syllabus, assignments, wikis, journals, and even discussions are posted online. And Blackboard also provides something else, a way for instructors to catch student plagiarists. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us to college to get us tutored on the Blackboard.
Chalkboard conjures up images of teachers noisily scrawling powdery white sentences and equations onto hanging pieces of black slate. As students strain to copy the information into their lined composition books, blackboards were phased out in the late 20th century, replaced by erasable white marker boards. And now students learn from smart boards, large interactive classroom computer screens. But Blackboard Learning is coming back into vogue.
The current system is Blackboard Learn, which we use campus-wide.
Chris Bray, an instructional designer, administers the interactive digital Blackboard Learning system for the University of Arkansas, a shared online technology which allows instructors and students to access course materials, films, journals, take tests, and even communicate via wikis and blogs way beyond the chalkboards.
Looking at last semester, there was probably about 3,600 courses using that in some regards. I can pull up some statistics. And, you know, probably about 7% of those courses are actually fully online. But the other 93% of the usage was really to supplement the face-to-face courses.
Face-to-face, that's how educators refer to the conventional classroom, rows of students led by a lecturing teacher. But in today's smart classroom, students bring in Kindles and laptops to take notes and access Blackboard data. They can also work from home, go to class at home, and teachers can work from home as well, especially during inclement weather. Chris Bray is surrounded by computer monitors in his small and noisy office in the old Gibson Annex, the Faculty Technology Center on the U of A campus. He's the point man for a fast-growing number of instructors, professors, and staff who are using the Blackboard learning system.
So instructors can go in and put, you know, their syllabus and their handouts and their readings on there. They can have discussion forums, post videos and audio recordings of their lectures, their classes. They can have the students turn in assignments. They can have the students take tests online. And a lot of stuff that, you know, was previously done in the classroom can now be moved to, you know, online and hopefully have more time in class for actual, you know, teaching and learning.
There's no question computers and social networks provide real efficiencies in education. But more important, professors and instructors understand they need to meet students where they are. And most students are intensely tethered to their devices. Because of that affinity, Bray says, young students easily adapt to Blackboard learning.
There are some online resources and things for the students to learn how to do that. But honestly, when the students go in, it's just another web page.
But Bray says even conventionally inclined teachers are adopting it.
You know, actually, over the years, I've seen a lot more older faculty embrace the technology and the systems in ways, you know, that I think is great. You've got older faculty that are set to retire or wanting to retire, but then they can come back and teach one or two classes, use either face-to-face with Blackboard or completely online, and, you know, they can teach the course from a cabin in the woods, you know, a hotel room, or I've known instructors who have actually been on cruise ships and, you know, responded to their students and did their stuff that way. So it allows for a lot more flexibility for the instructors just as much as the students.
Chris Bray's staff provides lots of tech support to instructors. Plus, he assures them that Blackboard security is tight, password protected, with all logins recorded and traceable. The Blackboard learning management system is not free. One digital education blog cited a single university license costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. Started up in 1997 by two college students, Blackboard Solutions went public in 2004, acquired multiple key competing software brands, then went global. It's widely used by business for analytics and training, and is now the leading commercial provider for online learning. And in 2011, Blackboard was reportedly sold to Providence Equity Partners for a cool $1.6 billion.
License-wise, it's paid for by based on a full-time equivalent of students. So every campus's, you know, price is different based on how many students they have.
Leading up to U of A classes starting this week, Chris Bray completed migration of all Blackboard data from being locally hosted to being managed by the company, an increasing trend in education, the commercialization and concentration of educational resources. Some say good, some say bad. In any case, the migration will ease access for both students and teachers, like Dr. Karen Madison, a senior instructor in the U of A English department.
I love chalkboards. I love the feel of chalk.
Karen Madison grew up with Blackboards, and she's gotten pretty savvy with the virtual one. She spoke from her home, where she was posting curriculum on Blackboard for her course on composition for teachers and a Writing Center tutor pedagogy, a method to establish writing centers in Arkansas schools. Someday, she said it took her a while to get used to this smart classroom.
And I really sort of was not wanting to get more and more into it. You know, I just really, it was like a slippery slope. I just kept getting more and more involved in it because we just had to be able to function. And I found that it was pretty easy to get used to. Once you get used to a certain stage, you know, it's sort of like a Pac-Man game. You just sort of get used to one stage and then you move up to the next stage. And that's how I did it.
A Pac-Man game, that dates our English teacher. But now she's totally game for Blackboard learning. She says it's eliminated paper and pencil grading.
I never miss a paper. If someone really turns a paper in, it's there. You know, I never can lose a paper that way. Students always are able to retrieve their papers.
With so much content on the web, students could easily select, copy, and paste their assignments together without proper attribution, as if it were original work. But plagiarism software, like the UA's Blackboard Safe Assign, has put the brakes on academic cheating, checking documents against millions of published online sources. The color-coded results pop up suspect passages with matching sources. Plagiarized papers are instantly ranked on a scale from 0 to 100%. But analyzing the scans can be tricky, says English instructor Karen Madison.
You know, you really have to kind of know what you're talking about before you really accuse someone of plagiarizing. But a lot of us, you know, who are new to it and are new to Safe Assign, you know, they're just trying to learn it, and they're doing pretty well.
Karen Madison believes a new technology has not deterred cheating so much, but is catching more cheaters and creating incentives to cheat the system.
The ones who buy their papers aren't getting caught, and that's another, they do that. And, I mean, buy their papers from somebody who actually writes it for them, and it's not in the system. It's not something that's, you know, bought from a mill online. And, you know, there are students who are really savvy about it, but the ones who aren't savvy about it get caught.
Madison says she approaches each paper as if it were an original work.
I never hope to find plagiarism when I open up my students' papers, ever, and it saddens me when I find it.
Back at Gibson Annex, UA Blackboard Administrator Chris Bray tests Safe Assign for us, scanning an English paper provided by Derek Lee, a UA Information Systems student who also happens to be the lobby guy at KUAF.
So I submitted his paper, your buddy, and it came up with zero, so he's good.
All original work and citations in order for Derek Lee. Bray says students are increasingly relying on programs like Safe Assign to double-check their work prior to submission.
Undergrads and also, you know, masters and graduate students, they'll want to, you know, before they publish their theses, they want to search it, have it run through Safe Assign to make sure that they've caught everything, that, you know, if they've cited it. So if it flags something, then they can verify that they actually cited it properly because, you know, they could have legitimately missed a citation somewhere.
The students caught plagiarizing, they're placed on academic review. Chronic offenders will be expelled. The UA Division of Student Affairs provides a website on standards and conduct where UA Provost Sharon Gaber recently posted a rather elementary video on academic integrity to clearly illustrate the point.
Imagine getting an appendectomy from a doctor who cheated through anatomy class. Or flying on an airplane designed by an engineer who bought a thesis online. Pretty scary, huh? Those examples are admittedly extreme cases.
UA Quality Writing Center has posted helpful hints on how to avoid plagiarism and provides face-to-face and online tutoring, quizzes, and drills to help improve retention. Lots of guidance is available for college students who, like generations before them, must reckon with the blackboard. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And the virtual Blackboard will also allow University of Arkansas students, faculty, and staff access to more than 12,000 news, videos, documents, and images. The U of A's global campus has acquired rights for at least a year from NBC Learn Higher Ed to stream or even download items from the NBC News Archives. The material, available at one of the largest news archives in the world, dates back to the 1920s. So if you search the archives today, you might see accounts of the first president to fly in a plane while in office. That would be Franklin Roosevelt. He flew from Miami to Morocco on this day in 1943 on his way to see British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Or you might be able to find an account of the so-called comeback concert for Elvis Presley. The Aloha concert was 40 years ago tonight in Honolulu. Or, of course, you can find thousands of other news files and images as well that did not take place on this particular day. The University of Arkansas Global Campus, by the way, supports the schools and colleges at the U of A with administration of online and distance learning opportunities. This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas's regular legislative session began at noon. The Republican Party is settling in as the new majority in Little Rock in both the House and the Senate. Among the topics scheduled for spirited conversation among lawmakers, the expansion of Medicaid in the state. As the session begins, Nathan Vandiver from our content partner KUAR offers a preview of what to expect in the next few months as legislators decide how to fund an expansion of health care for many of the state's poorest adults.
The state's Medicaid program is front and center in this year's legislative session for two reasons. One is a projected funding shortfall of about $139 million. The other is the possibility of expanding the program along with the federal health care law to cover an additional quarter of a million Arkansans. Incoming Speaker of the House Davy Carter sees the state's funding shortfall of Medicaid as something that will only build.
You know, it's a growing expense, and it's when we talk about prioritizing, allocating our capital, that is increasingly become taking a bigger piece of the pie, and we have a fundamental issue with the existing arrangement that we have today. We're already, as many states, if most states are, running in the red. It's unsustainable.
And he says he's looking at Medicaid's funding and increased funding that would be required of the state in the future if the legislature decides to take federal dollars and expand the program as something that could get in the way of other things like education.
I'm certain that the federal government cannot afford to do all that they've committed to do. But, we're members of the state legislature, and we're not in Washington, so we have to put a different hat on. But we have to address the fundamental challenges that we have in the existing Medicaid program, and we do that independently of analyzing the pros and cons of expanding it under a new set of rules. So when you couple all that together, when you put that in the context of education and higher ed and K-12 and all of these other important things that we're charged to do, it becomes a pretty major issue.
Currently, some cuts are proposed to the state's current Medicaid program, but the governor and others have said expanding Medicaid would bring in federal money that would avoid those cuts. However, the new Republican majority is largely wary of increasing Medicaid eligibility. Rob Moritz has covered the state legislature for 12 years. He's a reporter for Stevens Media's Little Rock Bureau and covers state government. He's been following the Medicaid funding shortfall and the possibility of expansion with the Affordable Care Act. He says the state has seen similar budget shortfalls in the past.
There were some funding shortfalls in DHS when Governor Huckabee was governor. And these things come in cycles. The issue here is when the economy went bad, more people were demanding services. And so the state was having to provide services. And this is happening in a lot of different states who are trying still to work their way out of the economic downturn. There have been shortfalls like this before. This isn't a new thing. The issue here is, while it is also just trying to find money to address the shortfall, there's also a lot of politics involved, because a lot of, mostly on the Republican side, are concerned about this and its connection with the Affordable Health Care Act.
Despite the political nature of the Medicaid expansion question, Moritz says Republicans and Democrats appear to be working well together, which will be necessary in order to find a solution to these problems. In Little Rock, I'm Nathan Vandiver.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Experience Works Senior Community Service Employment Program is currently accepting applications. Program applicants must be at least 55 years of age, unemployed, live in Benton, Carroll, Madison, or Washington counties, and have limited income. There are currently a number of openings for qualified candidates. Experience Works is available at no cost to people who meet eligibility criteria. The program provides paid community service assignments at local public and nonprofit organizations, training, referral to needed services, and job search assistance. For more information, 866-976-5939 or experienceworks.org. The life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. will be recognized this month with several events sponsored by the Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Planning Committee and the University of Arkansas Fort Smith. Events include a Ministerial Alliance prayer service Wednesday, a banquet on Saturday, a march and breakfast is scheduled for a week from today, the 21st. That's the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday, plus an awards presentation on January 22nd. For more information about any of these events, you can contact the University of Arkansas Fort Smith at 788-7006. Ahead on Ozarks at Large, another Monday conversation with a visiting professor. Late last year, Richard Sander from the UCLA School of Law came to the University of Arkansas to discuss affirmative action. While here, he discussed his book, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. The book, as you might imagine, has stirred some controversy, including protests on Sander's own campus, UCLA. Our discussion is ahead in about 7 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
Once a nun, Karen Armstrong now writes about the world's great faiths.
Muhammad actually was very, very keen on the emancipation of women. He liked women. He liked their company. He did his own chores. He mended his own clothes.
A prophet for our time, indeed. I'm Neil Conan. Talk of the Nation from NPR News, challenging our beliefs, changing our ideas.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 91.3 FM. Attention in Arkansas today is directed toward the state capitol as the General Assembly opens its session. But as Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business reports, there's plenty of news in the 7 days leading up to the first gavel of the 2013 session.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Well, for nearly a decade, natural gas drilling in Arkansas has been accused of harming the drinking water in the Fayetteville Shale Play. On Wednesday, the U.S. Geological Survey gave the industry a not guilty verdict. The federal agency released a report that said no evidence of groundwater contamination caused by gas drilling in the region could be connected. The Geological Survey sampled water from 127 domestic water wells in Van Buren and Faulkner counties in the heart of the drilling region. The surveyors were searching for unusual amounts of ions and trace metals, particularly methane and chloride concentrations, which can represent the byproduct of hydraulic fracking. The Geological Survey said it found no indication of contamination associated with drilling in the Fayetteville Shale area. Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe and officials with Walmart announced Thursday a health payment system that could create savings of around $15 million during the next fiscal year and $65 million in the year after that. Walmart said the new system is a groundbreaking effort to create a more patient-centered and cost-efficient health payment system within the state of Arkansas. Bentonville-based Walmart, which has around 57,000 employees in state, has agreed to pay $670,000 to underwrite the work and will participate in the new state program. Murphy Oil Corporation announced the appointment of Andrew Clyde as president and CEO of Murphy Oil USA. That is the U.S. retail marketing subsidiary of Murphy Oil Corporation, which will spin off from its parent company later this year. Murphy Oil USA currently has over 1,150 U.S. retail locations, and it recently announced an agreement with Walmart stores to provide access to over 200 new locations in the Midwest and southeastern United States. Clyde is a partner in Booz & Company's global energy practice and has over 20 years of experience in management consulting. Incoming Speaker of the House, Representative Davey Carter, is leaving his bank job, while one-time Speaker-elect Representative Darren Williams will take a banking job. Carter announced on Thursday he'd stepped down from his job with Centennial Bank, a subsidiary of Conway-based Home Bank Shares, in order to focus on his House duties. Carter, who is also an attorney, has held the position of division president with the bank. He'll remain on the regional bank's board. Effective February 1st, Williams, also a lawyer, will be the new CEO of Southern Bank Corp. Southern is a community development bank that works with underserved communities in the Mid-South. Williams has been a principal in a law firm that focuses on consumer protection litigation. Unemployment rates in Arkansas's 8 metropolitan statistical areas all declined in November of 2012 compared to 1 year ago. The Fayetteville-Springdale-Rogers MSA had the lowest jobless rate in the state at 4.6%. The Pine Bluff MSA had the highest unemployment rate at 8.3% in November of 2012, but that was down a full percentage point from the previous year. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
It's Monday, January 14th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Mondays. Plenty to do on Mondays anymore.
Yeah.
At 1 o'clock, you can go to Crystal Bridges for a drawing exploration. This is not like the drop-in drawing. This is a study of Martin Johnson Heed's work.
Oh, wow.
It's $45, and you can find out more at crystalbridges.org.
Mm-hmm.
There's an art show opening today at the University of Arkansas Department of Fine Arts Gallery called Employing Voice, Embracing Agency, Contemporary African-American Artists. It's artists from the collection of Darryl Walker, who played basketball at the UA and played basketball in the NBA. And didn't you tell me he was a women's basketball coach?
He was head coach in the WNBA. I believe he's the only one or one of only two people to be a head coach in both the NBA and the WNBA.
Wow. And that speaks to he's had plenty of opportunity to see and collect art.
Yes.
So this will be open through February 28th. You know where the gallery is. It's around the corner, kind of, from the theater.
Right.
Which is
right.
Where everything is to me.
Right.
Yoga continues at 5:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library, and it's free. And auditions tonight for Go Dog Go.
Okay. And this is at ACL, Art Center of the Ozarks.
Art Center of the Ozarks.
Now, Go Dog Go, when I was a kid, I mean like 5, 6, 7, this is my favorite book. I still have my copy of Go Dog Go. How is this going to be a theatrical presentation? Are you familiar with the book?
I'm not.
It's just these wonderful, wonderful pictures. It's not Dr. Seuss, but it's in the same vein. And it's a dog in a little jalopy saying, I like your hat. And the other dog says, I like your hat. It helps you learn to read. It's a wonderful, but I don't know how it's going to be on the stage.
Well, you should go to auditions tonight.
I should, shouldn't I?
And find out.
Okay.
It'll be fun.
Okay.
Their children's productions are always delightful. So you can find out more by dropping by the Art Center at 7 o'clock tonight.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
50 years ago, George Wallace gave his first inaugural address as governor of Alabama, and he uttered these infamous words.
Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Remembering one of the most notorious speeches in American history, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon at 3 on KUAF 91.3 FM. This is Ozarks at Large. Late last semester, the University of Arkansas School of Law invited Richard Sander, a law professor from UCLA, to speak on campus. Sander is the author of several controversial articles, editorials, and a book about what he calls the failure of affirmative action on college campuses throughout the country. Sander, with degrees from Harvard and Northwestern, researches questions of social and economic equality. His latest book regarding affirmative action is titled Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. During his time in Northwest Arkansas this fall, Richard Sander came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to me about his research and opinions, about the protests and criticisms leveled against him, and about his book. I asked him about a word he used in the title, mismatch.
It's capturing the idea that there's an optimal learning environment for any student, and that is where you're at a school where the median student is someone not too far from you in academic preparation. And it's possible to have both a positive and a negative mismatch. If you go to a school, suppose you go to a community college, and you actually want to be a rocket scientist, you'd be positively mismatched because the teachers would not be covering material that's challenging to you. Negative mismatch occurs when you go to a school that is mostly inhabited by students who have stronger academic preparation. The teacher is probably teaching to them and not you, and that can lead to less learning.
You have used the example that perhaps a student who is entering a fine school might be mismatched if they're entering a perhaps more competitive school.
That's right.
I think I read in The Atlantic an adaptation from the book, you use maybe Richmond, but you find yourself at Duke. You say that affirmative action has created this mismatch, especially for young students of color.
Right. Mismatch is something that can happen to anyone. It's not purely a racial phenomenon. And we certainly use preferences in schools for athletes and for legacy students and all sorts of reasons. But we use particularly large preferences for African Americans and sometimes for Hispanics. And they're sufficiently pervasive that they really affect the overall educational outcomes of those groups.
The argument that this mismatch is doing nobody any good, that you're actually a good intention, you would argue, is actually hurting the people, the students, the young men and women who perhaps it was designed to help.
That's right. And it's important to keep in mind, not only is this not limited to race, but it's also not an argument about whether students should go to college. There's a tremendous range of college in the U.S., and African Americans currently are about 30% more likely to go to a four-year college than whites with similar credentials and academic background. So it's not fundamentally a question of access. It's a question of trying to maximize how effective that college education is. Because even though blacks are more likely to start college, they're about 30% less likely to end up with a degree than comparable white students. And this is even more true in areas like science and engineering, where mismatch seems to have a particularly powerful effect. So we're investing a lot of resources. We've done a lot to open access, but we haven't done a very good job of sort of optimizing the educational outcomes for blacks and Hispanics who get into college.
Don't let me put words in your mouth. But the idea being here that some of the schools that have affirmative action are taking students who perhaps have not been as prepared as other students that they'll be sitting by at that college or university.
Right. So let's take law school, for example. We admit currently American Legal Education admits about 4,000 blacks a year. There are about 200 law schools. Blacks have a bar failure rate that's about four times as high as it is for whites. And part of that is because many blacks are coming in with just weaker academic preparation from college to high school. But about half of that bar passage gap, we think, is due to mismatch and could be eliminated by better allocating black students across schools. So elite schools seek diversity. They want to expand opportunity. They use aggressive preferences to try to admit students who don't necessarily do well. And they also then change the behavior of every other law school because those law schools, if they want diversity, now have to admit students that are less academically prepared too because the students that would fit well at their school have been admitted by a more elite school. So University of Arkansas needs to use preferences partly because blacks who are highly qualified to do extremely well here are being competed for by national universities.
Let me play devil's advocate a bit. Okay. This may mean then that the best schools continue at this point for a number of reasons to have a large amount of white affluent students. And doesn't that just continue that? Because I'm a University of Arkansas alum, and we're proud of the education we get here. But let's face it, if I'm up against a Harvard grad or a Duke grad or a UCLA grad, all things being even, those grads will get a job before me. So isn't it perpetuating this sort of elite system?
Well, there are two answers to that, maybe even more. But let me give you two. One is that when we talk about eliteness, we tend to sort of make white and Asian synonymous with eliteness. And the way preferences work these days, it's really leaves socioeconomic disadvantage out of the equation. The great majority of students who receive preferences into elite schools, regardless of the race, are upper middle class. So we're not really creating the kind of pathway to opportunity that we think we are and that we were back in the 1970s and 80s. Affirmative action has become much more homogeneous in terms of the basic eliteness of the students affected. The second thing is that all things are not equal when you're competing with a more elite student because you have to think about how you're going to perform at that school. So if you go to a school where you receive a large preference, you're probably going to have lower grades. And if you have less learning as well, that affects your competitiveness in the job market too. So we've done research. Most of my research has been on law graduates on this particular question. But if you kind of compare law graduates who came into law school with similar inputs and then graduate and they do pass the bar, they get past that type of mismatch and they're competing on the job market, and you look at what's sort of the outcome of a high GPA student at a middle tier school versus a low GPA student at a higher tier school, the grades really do seem to trump the eliteness. You seem to generally be better off being a high GPA student. So much so that the head of the National Association of Law Placement recently changed the advice that they give to graduates and urged people to start paying attention to the relative position a student will have when they go to law school.
When affirmative action began in the 1960s and 1970s, it was an idea that would foster equality, right? The little, if any, argument that there was a disparity. Did it work in its infancy, in its beginnings?
It was working pretty well in its beginnings. And part of the idea was that affirmative action has to open doors that have been closed, and it has to get us to rethink kind of our qualification systems. And that did happen. You know, there were a lot of schools that colleges were not recruiting at when affirmative action started. And it got admissions officers to really think in terms of a larger box. So I think those early efforts were quite effective in increasing inclusion. The premise of a lot of those early efforts was that we need to jumpstart race preferences now because, this was in the late 1960s and a lot of campuses seemed very illegitimate to their own students and to society. They seemed too much like bastions of privilege. So they said, well, we'll jumpstart this. And as educational disparities even out in American society, the need for these preferences will go away. And there was tremendous progress made in the 70s and 80s in the black-white test score gap, for example. Minorities really did start doing dramatically better in high school. The number of high school graduates from minority populations went way up. But around 1990, progress in the test score gap really slowed down and eventually stopped. So schools that thought that they would be long past preference systems by the year 2000 still found themselves very dependent on that. And that was also when the shift to focusing on more elite subpopulations within minority groups happened as well. So affirmative action sort of became more institutionalized, and at the same time it became less more to its original goal of really trying to open up doors that have been closed.
It seems we're talking about a much bigger problem, about the ability to get as many students ready for higher education as we can, that there's still a gap in the readiness. And again, it's perhaps a socioeconomic or a regional factor.
The interesting thing is that you can make a pretty good argument that our current preference system has allowed us to ignore this underlying problem you're talking about, which is the test score gap and why the K-12 system is not eliminating that gap. And that argument picks up a lot of support when you look at what's happened in states that have banned racial preferences. California was the first in 1996.
They're Prop 209?
Yeah, that's right. There are now 7 or 8 states that have done things like Prop 209. And Richard Kallenberg at the Century Foundation recently released a report where he showed that in almost every one of those states, universities started really focusing on the K-12 system after the bans went into effect. I saw this myself in California. The University of California started spending tens of millions of dollars on K-12 partnerships. That actually worked. They actually got a lot more students into the pipeline because preferences can be a very easy, sort of a very painless way for a university to achieve diversity in freshman numbers. But it's not really either dealing with the fundamental problem in the pipeline, nor is it really maximizing the educational outcomes of students. So one thing that a racial ban can do is it can focus more attention on the K-12 pipeline.
So instead of a shiny coat of paint,
you can actually work on the whatever is under that paint and try to strengthen it.
Yeah, the other thing that I think we really need, and racial bans have some other pretty unattractive consequences. Something we really need is transparency, and that will get the university's focus on the outcome side. Right now, there's no law school in the country, for example, that tells students how their credentials relate to their performance in the bar exam. So many students go to law schools where the law school knows that they only have a 40 or 50% chance of passing the bar, but the school-wide rate is, say, 85 or 90%, and that's the only thing that student can find out about. So the students can't use self-help to sort of figure out how can I avoid the mismatch problem. There just isn't any information to do it. If the schools provide that information, students would be more empowered, and I think the schools would be under a lot more pressure to try to fix the problems. They might change their admissions. They might develop academic support programs to improve outcomes. But right now they're able to essentially hide beneath the diversity program.
If that's the case, and I'm a university that has that sort of those figures, I'm not exactly 100% interested in having more transparency necessarily.
Yeah, it's never going to come, at least not in my lifetime, from universities deciding to suddenly do this. There's some chance that the Supreme Court will mandate more transparency in the affirmative action case that's before the court this term. There's also a lot of discussion. There's a growing consensus, I think, among thoughtful critics of the preference system that transparency is needed.
You and your co-author Stuart Taylor Jr. have, one of you or both of you have written that this is kind of the third rail. No one wants to touch this in academia.
Yeah, university administrators have realized that that wading into the merits of preferences is the surest road to retirement. I get lots of fan mail from retired administrators, former administrators, who say, keep up the good fight. But present administrators almost never want to talk about this. So pressure for change has to come from the outside. Maybe it's the court. Maybe it's legislators. Civil Rights Commission has issued two reports calling for Congress to mandate more transparency. But a lot of politicians see this as a third rail, too. So it's not clear where reform will come, but there's certainly growing sentiment for it.
You mentioned you get fan mail. Imagine occasionally something crosses your desk that qualifies as something other than fan mail.
Occasionally. There was a near riot at UCLA a couple of weeks ago about part of my book, which found that UCLA had covertly reinstituted racial preferences.
Which would be against state law.
That's correct, because of Prop 209. And I was pointing out that there had been so much pressure on the university to try to get freshman numbers back to pre-209 levels, and so much reluctance by the university to point out how dramatically better graduation rates were since race neutrality started, that the students were quite upset. And the university, in response to my book, said, we're not going to change anything that we're doing. They didn't try to prove that what they were doing was legal. They just said, don't worry, we're not making any change to it. But interestingly, the student paper on campus really tried to get a dialogue going. And students who were initially pretty upset really started thinking about what's going on. And there's a diversity group on campus that's arranged for a big forum next week at UCLA. So I think that I think if people get enough information about the underlying facts, one can change the politics of this a little bit.
Finally, when you think of certain flash issues, hot button issues, gay marriage, abortion, some of these others, they're generally, with a broad brush, is this left versus right, liberal versus conservative. Often, when you mention affirmative action, that broad brush gets painted there. Is that fair, and can we make progress if that sort of short opinion exists?
It's tough. I think the left-right divide has dominated the affirmative action debate really since the 1970s, where the left says equal opportunity means trying to get results that are relatively similar across groups, and the right says equal opportunity means being completely colorblind, right? So the debate has been in that rut for a long time. And what's happened in the last 10 years, not just from my work, but really from 20 or 30 other scholars collectively, is more of a focus on the empiricism and saying, let's actually think about what works. And if you do that, it takes it out of the ideological box, because you're then saying we have a limited amount of political capital that we can spend on good efforts to try to help achieve better racial results, better racial equality in America. Let's try to put that in areas where it's actually going to have an effect. Let's not invest political capital in areas where we may be doing things that are counterproductive. So that sort of logic, and I think shifting the focus towards socioeconomic diversity, towards K-12 improvement, all those things I think can really reconfigure many aspects of the affirmative action debate into one where progressives should be coalescing around this critical opinion.
Is there a website where people can learn more about the book?
Yes. There's something called Project CEAPHE, S-E-A-P-H-E, that has a lot of information about it and related research.
Richard Sander, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Richard Sander is a law professor at UCLA and a co-founder of the program in Public Interest Law and Policy. He is also the author of the book Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. He spoke on the University of Arkansas campus late last semester, and during his time in Northwest Arkansas, he came to our studios for our conversation. This is Ozarks at Large.
On the next Fresh Air, Gene Robinson reflects on his time as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church. He's just retired. For years, Robinson received death threats. One suspect was arrested with photos of Robinson.
He had scrawled across them, "Save the church, kill the bishop," and he had a sawed-off shotgun and tons of ammunition.
Join us.
Fresh Air with Terry Gross, tonight at 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM. And time now to award three lucky listeners a pair of tickets each to see Threepenny Acre and the Steel Wheels at George's Majestic Lounge a week from tomorrow night. The concert is January 22nd, 2013, a week from tomorrow night. Music expected to start around 9 o'clock. Threepenny Acre, of course, from Fayetteville. And we expect the new CD from Threepenny Acre out sometime this calendar year. The Steel Wheels, who were partially stole the show, at least, from the Roots Festival this past August in Fayetteville. This is the first time the Steel Wheels have been back since the Roots Fest. And on Friday, my colleague Antoinette Grajeda and I asked a question about Arkansas County that you had to answer. Send an email to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. Friday was the 150th anniversary of the end of the Battle of Arkansas Post, a very significant Union victory west of the Mississippi in the early years of the Civil War. The question was, in Arkansas County, where Arkansas Post is, it's now an unincorporated community, but I did ask, what are the two, either of the two county seats of Arkansas County? Many of you knew the answer, DeWitt and Stuttgart. Everyone who answered at least one of those goes into the drawing. And the winners for these tickets, two tickets each to see Threepenny Acre and the Steel Wheels at George's Majestic Lounge in Dixon Street in Fayetteville, Amy Brinkley, Brian Beasley, and Derek Lynn. Congratulations. I will be emailing the three of you to tell you about your tickets. You will be able to pick them up here at the KUAF studios. We have just enough Tim Ernst 2013 calendars to also give you a calendar each along with your two tickets. Now, if you did not win, don't fret. We have two more pairs of tickets that we'll give away perhaps tomorrow or the day after on Ozarks at Large. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Wicks. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks so much for tuning in. Don't forget, if you'd like to hear anything from this show again, you can go to our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. Listen to any show that we've produced in the last 2.5 years. Also, individual stories available there. You can also find out more about the music that we play inside the shows. Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow at noon for another new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks so much for listening. Have a pleasant Monday.